This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Folding pocket.
Welcome to another episode of the Rabbit Hole Detectives, a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice pronounces a winner. So hello again, rabbit holeers.
Hello, Kat.
Nearly.
Hello, Kat.
Hello, Kat.
Hello, both.
How are you doing?
Thank you.
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Well, thrilled to see you getting this enormously high-profile interview in the lands of your birth.
Yeah, I was promoting the Norwegian version of the bone chests called Kongenes knokler.
Obviously, yes.
I knew you'd like that one, Richard. Yes, and they did lots of media, so it was very nice. I got to go on a talk show and have all my hair and makeup done and everything. So
and speak Norwegian instead of having to do this.
You know what? That was actually quite hard, believe it or not.
Well, it's interesting about that, because you lived here for so long. Clearly, you sort of think in English as well as Norwegian, and you've got other languages too. So going back into Norwegian, it takes a little bit of time to adapt. It
and also, does. Can I ask, do your parents think you have an English accent now?
Luckily not, I don't think. But there are definitely things. I used to, as a teenager, I used to do voiceover work in Norway, actually. And there was a point where the woman who employed me said, well, couldn't really use me for Norwegian anymore because really? She could pick up an accent and it had to be a sort of pure, completely Norwegian. So, sadly. But no, it's hard. It's hard to talk about my work academically because my academic Norwegian is non-existent, really, because I've not
and English,
done
I suppose, is more the standard lingua franca in that field. Yeah.
And the thing that's interesting when you're speaking in a different language is that you feel like you cannot express yourself as eloquently, and you know you've got the ideas there, but you just can't find quite the words, and you sort of everything
it's a
you
express. I have every day.
Just in general,
just struggle on.
But I should have said, I'll have to send you the link, Richard, because after me on this talk show, there was always a musical or performance. Guess what they had after me?
I don't know.
Folk dance. Norwegian folk dance.
Oh. You've hit Richard's sweet spot very early on in the podcast.
I'm good for what I'm to say now.
Yeah.
So I feel my cup runneth over.
Yes.
Did you dance a couple of steps?
I knew you would ask me that, and the answer is no, they wouldn't let me, so...
Oh, no,
sort of,
that's very...
They'd fall over themselves to let you.
Well, someone would fall over. It would probably be me, to be honest. But there we go. Should we go straight into it today?
Yes.
Okay, because we've got some brilliant topics. And Richard, you're first up this week, and your topic is shopping malls.
Shopping malls, or malls. I suppose we say mall, wouldn't we? Step with me, if you will, to Piccadilly in the Regency. Lord Burlington at Burlington House is getting fed up, right? Because there's an alleyway down the side of his walled garden, and people throw their old oyster shells and rubbish over the wall into his garden. He's had enough of this. So he decides to build a sort of covered arcade, I suppose. And he gets sort of the idea of commercialising. He says, what if we have smart retailers in a covered arcade? The Burlington Arcade, opened in 1819, still going today. Famous for its Beatles, who will chuck you out if you whistle. I've tried this, by the way, and the Beatle showed me tolerance and compassion.
Wait, hang on, what's a beadle?
The beadle is a sort of private policeman. They wear frock coats and top hats at the Burlington Arcade. There are certain, not quite bylaws exactly, but sort of customs of the house, if you see what I mean. And whistling, which is considered bawdy, you can get thrown out of the arcade for it. But they didn't. They were fine with me. It was all right.
Did they have a word or just look at
me? No, they looked to me in a sort of knowing way, thinking, oh, here's another smart ass whistling in the arcade. But they've all got earpieces and walkie-talkies now as well. But an arcade, there was a precedent in Paris in the 1790s, the first came along. There was a huge explosion, of course, in retail in the 19th century. The Galleria, Vittorio Emanuele II. In Milan, one of the most magnificent and grandest of shopping arcades, you can call it that, opened in 1877. So the idea of enclosing space for retail is an old one. It goes back, of course, to the bazaars, I suppose, of the Middle East. But the shopping mall, as we know it, which is an entirely enclosed space, was really the invention of a remarkable man called Victor Gruen. Victor Gruen was born in Vienna in 1903 and went to the art school that refused to admit Adolf Hitler, interestingly. He left there and he immersed himself in the kind of artistic and socialist circles of Vienna. He presented a famous cabaret in Vienna and started an architectural practice. He was a student of Peter Behrens, the great Peter Behrens, who built the first modernist house in England. Where, Charles Spencer?
Gosh, you got me there.
Northampton.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Where was it?
You know the Bassett-Loke family?
Yes.
Who got Charles René Mackintosh to do the Durnger?
Yes.
Well, New Ways on the Wellingborough Road, the first modernist house in England built by Peter Behrens, who taught Victor Gruen. The Anschluss came along. Victor Gruen, wisely, he was Jewish, got out of there, came to America, arrived in 1938, according to him, with $8, an architectural degree and no English to his name. So he kind of found a place in the emigre community in New York. And then he was asked to design a leather goods shop for Fifth Avenue. He thought, yes, OK, I'll do that. So he designed it with a recessed entrance. This was a new thing. Most shops were kind of flush with the facade of the building, if you see what I mean. But he built this recess, which was glazed on both sides, so the shopkeeper could display wares. What do we got there? We've got the sort of beginnings of an arcade. He moved to Los Angeles and became naturalised. And then with the rise of the car and also the expansion of America and the sprawl of the suburbs, he thought, I could do something here. What he wanted to do was to essentially bring an integrated cosmopolitan experience to the suburbs of America. He wanted to recreate something of the kind of boulevard life of Vienna, something that integrated retail, residential and commercial. And so he decided on the idea of the shopping mall. First one, famous one he built was Southdale, which is in Edina, Minneapolis, a suburb of Minneapolis, which opened in 1956. And it was entirely enclosed. And the reason he did that was because it was Minneapolis. And if you've ever been in the winter in Minneapolis, you will know that it's a very inclement place to be indeed. So he created a total environment. You could give it coolness in summer, you could give it warmth in winter, and you could create, what he wanted to create was amenities. So there would be somewhere you could get something to eat, there'd be like a goldfish pond or something, there would be trees, a sort of atrium of fun. And what he wanted to do was to get people in and up and down and walking and interacting and talking, to give them a rich experience in the rather characterless sprawl of suburbia. So that's what started. His practice took off enormously and the mall expanded hugely. He was also clever. He realised that to make this work, you needed two things. You needed to make it easily accessible. So as the car began to become more and more important and more of them were driven by more and more people, the parking lot became bigger and bigger. And you needed an anchor store. So at either end of the shopping mall, he put what was called an anchor store, JCPenney's, a Macy's, a Barnes & Noble, a kind of big store which people would make their way to, but they would have to pass other shops and may be attracted to go into those other shops. He also built it on two floors, so you'd kind of circulate around this space. And the Gruen transfer, as sociologists call it, occur. And that is when you go in to buy one thing and you come out with four things because you'd walk past other shops and been enticed into them. So everybody was happy. It was great for shoppers. It was great for retailers. It was great for planners. Very quickly, of course, it began to go wrong because the proliferation was such and the profits that could be made so enticing that the kind of recreational and residential elements of his sort of mix were extracted. And in the end, it became a really naked enterprise to get people to part with their cash. So they became much more commercialized. And they expanded at this incredible rate. By 2010, I think there was something like 110,000 shopping malls in the United States alone. And all sorts of problems began to happen almost immediately. If you were a teen in America in the 1980s, you'd spend half your life in the mall. That's where you'd go. You'd hang out with your friends. But of course, they weren't spending any money. They were just hanging out. Sometimes teens being teens could behave quite badly. There were issues around public order, or public disorder, I should say, antisocial behaviour. And that began to drive people out too. Also, the expense of running a mall is extraordinary. If you think about it, your air conditioning or heating, an enormous space, used to be carpeted. They took carpet out because it showed that it produced a bit of friction. And if you had like a shiny marble floor, you'd get more people through more quickly. And because it was such a tempting offer to retailers, they just really over-retailed. They just built more and more and more of them. And then, of course, along came, inevitably, the crunch of decline. And in the 1990s, things began to, partly because there were so many of them, but partly also because people got a bit fed up with them, I think. There were different models prevailed. The big box store happened. So you get like a giant, giant Barnes & Noble or something with a parking lot outside. So there was no need to pay the overheads of looking after all the amenity end that a public mall would have. And so the malls then began to fall into decline. And now it's a big thing in America, what they call dead malls. And dead malls, it's actually got its own Facebook group, dead malls, because there are so many of them that once you get under 40% occupancy, it's considered to be dying. But some remain open because it's actually less expensive to keep them open than to close and demolish them. If you're an American senior, the second most likely place you're going to go take a walk with your pals is a dead mall, in fact. That's not the neighbourhood, but the dead mall, because you've got a conditioned environment, right?
Yes. Yeah.
They also have security guards, right? So it's become very popular for older people to go and take their constitutional up and down the mall. They've become repurposed for housing of homeless people. They've become fulfillment centres for major retailers. Of course, online retailing has greatly affected it too. Mm. And the irony is they're beginning to re-find their usefulness, actually in a way consistent with Victor Gruen's original vision. They now become places where you go for lifestyle reasons. He repudiated it. He was hailed as perhaps the most influential architect of the 20th century because of the success of the shopping mall. But he declared, actually in London, I think in the 1980s, he disavowed his bastard child because it had not created what he wanted to do, which was a rich cosmopolitan experience, but just produced a sort of suburban blight. And yet now the mall is once again finding its place in a way that is more congruent with his vision.
So I find travelling around America, most shopping malls are incredibly bleak now, aren't they? They're very ugly things, very functional. When did Americans stop minding about them looking like a sort of blight on the landscape? You explained about the explosion of consumerism, but is there an era where you suddenly thought, actually, it doesn't matter?
Well, I think it was because retailers got so good at extracting maximum money out of customers. And the way they did that was by pandering to their tastes, of course. So we all think we, you know, are independent creatures who make our minds up thoughtfully about our purchases, but we're not. We're subject to all the sort of beguilements that they do. And so things like, you know, removing the carpet to get you through the building quicker, the situation of the anchor stores, so you have to walk past lots of shops to do it. Mm. I think what it does is it excites our appetites and maybe gets something firing up in our limbic systems. And so, I mean, I've done it myself. You've done that thing where you go to a shop and you buy something that you neither want nor need. And you think, what on earth did I do that for? But you realise you've sort of just been provoked into doing it by a clever retailer who has anticipated your nervous system. Or
well, we know that, how they lay out supermarkets and you put the different foods next to each other.
And IKEA.
Of course.
Have you ever been to IKEA, Charles?
I've not yet been to an IKEA.
Some people might say that. Have you been to IKEA?
I just love IKEA.
Good. Thank goodness.
But the thing is, I mean, the IKEA very consciously uses the Gruen transfer. Mm. You get lost in the shop. You know how difficult it is to find your way to the loo or to find your thing? They don't want you to find your way. They want you to wander endlessly round and round and round this retail environment, picking up things as you go, like a bee sucking pollen from a garden of plants.
It's incredibly difficult to go in there with a shopping list of just buying, thinking you're going to buy one thing and then go out again.
But it's also why it failed, because they simply over-retailed. They were just more and more competitors in the field, and in the end they just
and online
ran out of
shopping
customers.
All online shopping, so I do most of my shopping online.
Do you?
Same.
I read somewhere, I don't know if this is true, that men in particular find shopping a hell of an ordeal, and I think it's something to do with the fact that up until 10,000 years ago the average human would probably come across a total of 50 people in their lifetime. And so to be jostling with 50,000 in a shopping mall is really quite testing.
There's this brilliant thing they have in Chinese shopping malls, which really exploded in China with the rise of, you know, people having more money. And it's literally called the husband wardrobe. And it's a place where you go to the shopping mall and you put your husband in a room where they've got comfy chairs and snacks and drinks and also huge televisions showing sport. So you literally, you just put your husband, and perhaps you take a ticket, I don't know, and then you go and you do your shopping and you come back and you collect your husband at the end and go home.
You've got to make sure it's you collect crash. The right husband.
Yeah, what if you want that?
There may be some bit of an upgrade. Yeah.
But I do know they have a husband wardrobe.
Yeah,
that's so brilliant.
It's supposed to be a crash. That's what you do for kids and in little...
But with husbands.
Yeah.
I love shopping.
I don't like it either, so I'm quite happy to go there. So.
I love shopping.
No, not a fan.
My favourite way of shopping is to look at everything and buy nothing. So I'm one of the reasons why malls would go out of business.
You're a seismic fault in the system.
Yeah, and I'll go online, I think.
Would you like to know
your favourite fact?
Would you like to know my favourite fact?
Yes, please.
Well, it's this. Because of the success of the shopping mall, there are 2 billion parking spaces in the United States of America.
Oh, my word.
There are 8 parking spaces for every man, woman and child in the United States. And so you have now these kind of wastelands of cracking asphalt or blacktop around these dead malls. As America, once so thriving, so prosperous, shining brightly on its hill, has become a sort of wasteland. It's like, you know, there's apocalyptic films. They always film them, don't they, in deserted shopping malls. There's always a scene when they do that. Well, I think it's actually because the wasteland is already here, and it's when you go and see a dead mall.
Gosh, it's such a sort of microcosm of retail and society and aspiration, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
Yes.
That's very interesting. Growing up in Oslo in the 90s, we did hang out in the shopping centres. That was very much a thing.
Some say the earliest shopping mall of all was actually Swedish. Oh. But I've got a question for you, if I may.
Mm.
Where is the largest shopping mall in the world?
It's going to be Dubai or somewhere, surely.
Charles?
That's a very good guess by Kat. I don't know. Tokyo?
Tehran.
Oh, my goodness.
It's called the Iran Mall. 21 million square feet of leasable space within it. Because in America, we're talking about something that's peaked and fallen. But in the East, and in particularly in the burgeoning economies like Dubai and so forth, but also in Tehran of all places, and in Asia, in South Asia and India, the shopping mall continues to grow and thrive and prosper. I suppose it's where newly rich middle classes begin to emerge. The shopping mall makes sense. Oh, 21 million square feet.
You can't
think
of that.
You can't really see
very much in a day,
can you?
You don't think of Tehran as a place you go to hang out in the mall, do you?
No, absolutely not.
But I guess in places like that also with the climate and air conditioning, anywhere where that makes a lot of sense.
It's exactly. The opposite of Minnesota.
Yes.
Extraordinary heat and humidity.
Yeah. And I've been in Toronto in the winter and they have a huge shopping mall that's entirely underground.
Yeah.
Because it's just too bitingly cold up on the top.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Canada slightly bucks the trend in a way. Their relationship to the mall is slightly different. But then Canada always surprises me by being much less like America than I think
it
is.
Yes, that's very true.
Hmm. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Well,
we're going to move on to you, actually.
Yes, well, you can see my pathetic guess of Tokyo comes about because my topic is Japanese cuisine.
Yes.
And I think there are central tenets which we understand, us in the West. But essentially, I think the whole concept of it was about balance, both in terms of flavour and nutrition. That's how it really started. And also it's become very much an essential part of national identity. I remember going around Japan the first time I went there in the mid-80s, and there was huge confusion because the children were growing so fast and these schoolrooms that had worked for generations, the children could no longer fit.
Fat or tall?
Fat and tall. They were eating American-style and European foods. And we're growing stoutly and strongly. Whereas the national identity, it's so important, the food to the Japanese, that their Japanese food is respected, that there was a sort of parody cartoon that came out recently called The Sushi Police, checking that it's all being done properly. And there's also a thing called sushi terrorism, which is a sort of defiling the concept of Japanese food. And last year, social media went very, very mad and upset in Japan when these pranksters started doing things, filming themselves, drinking directly from a soy sauce bottle in a Japanese restaurant. That caused huge offence nationally.
Kissing nothing makes my heart sink more than the thought of pranksters. It's a phenomenon of our time that we could all do well without.
Well, it's that, and also taking sushi from one of the plates and just leaving a few crumbs there and then leaving it in the restaurant as something that people might enjoy. This is looking back at traditional dishes and making fun of them in a terrible way. So Japanese food, collectively, is known as washoku. And traditionally, if you go back to the real roots of it, it would be rice, of course, with miso soup, pickles, and then three dishes, of which one would probably be fish. That's your absolute blueprint for Japanese food.
Can I just clear one thing up? Most people, I think, in Britain think sushi means a bit of fish and a bit of rice, but that's not sushi, right?
It comes from this thing called funazushi, as opposed to sushi. And this was something from the sort of Osaka, Kyoto, and Nara area. It's not a raw fish originally. It would be fermented and salted. And it probably came, the whole sushi route in terms of funazushi probably stems from the 8th century from China. And it involved mainly freshwater fish. It's very umami rich, the taste of the fermented salted fish, and quite cheesy. I think it's very difficult for the Western palate, quite a challenge, an acquired taste. But it's a popular treat at New Year. But you look at the other ones that we know very well, the famous tastes over here. And I was thinking of the soba, you know, the buckwheat noodle.
Mm.
So for quite a long time, that was seen as peasant food. And it wasn't until the 17th century when some great aristocrat was passing through the northeast area where it's now the main noodle there is called wanko soba. And that
like
was
my 1980s.
I don't think you were very sober though, were you? And,
90s.
The buckwheat was considered very rustic, but this nobleman served it alongside the finer dishes. And he kept saying, no, I want more of that. I want more of that. And it went from being a sort of rather peasant dish to something that was an essential part. And the wanko soba is really an all-you-can-eat buckwheat soba noodle now with side dishes. But it's served in a way you're not allowed to take a break. This is something totally against how we consider Japanese food. I've always thought it's many little dishes, so you're always taking a break and hopefully not getting too full. And there are parts of Osaka, for instance. Osaka has more centenarians, more people who live to over 100 than anywhere else in the world. And they think that's to do with a very healthy, not just the diet they eat, but the fact that they only ever eat till they judge themselves to be 80% full. They're never stuffed like we tend to be in
the West. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah, it's cultural and a politeness thing, and also very clever knowledge of your own abilities as a human, really. If you want to learn how to live for a very long time, they don't really do rice so much there. Their carbs mainly come from sweet potato, and they eat a lot of plants, much less animal protein than is common in our diet. There's also ramen is very important as a Japanese dish. This is actually it can be a pork-based broth in the south of Japan or a miso-based broth in the north. And again, you forget that there were ancient familiarities really between China and Japan that were snuffed out in the Middle Ages and resurgences occurred. But essentially, China did influence the Japanese cuisine quite a lot. And the first Japanese noodles were, in fact, Chinese. We think very much that they're distinct, Chinese and Japanese culinary skills, but they're not.
But like the ceramic traditions, very close, complex relationship between
yes,
the two.
Yes, that would make sense. The reason that ramen became so popular was actually 101 years ago, in 1923. There was the great Kanto earthquake, and the traditional restaurants were flattened. And it was easy on a stall, a ramen stall, to serve people food. And that's when they really took off as a popularity thing. So in a ramen, you would have noodles, stock, the sauce of your choice, fat and oil, and often pork belly, chili, bean sprout and spring onion. I'm going to get into one of the favourite fascinations, I think, of the Westerner with Japanese cuisine when I touch on pufferfish.
Oh, yes.
Now, this contains the lethal neurotoxin TTX. And nowadays, if you want to be a qualified cook or chef involved with the pufferfish, you have to gain a licence, and that involves 2 years training under another fugu chef, as they're known. The bits you have to avoid are the liver and the ovaries. The product of marine bacteria builds up in the fish's system and sits very, very strongly there. And it's very difficult to do anything about it. You can't cook it out. You can't freeze it out. It's going to survive. The Japanese tend to like to leave a tiny bit of that poison in. So it gives a tingle to the lips and tongue, a warmth to and flushing to your skin, and a euphoria and exhilaration. But you know about it if you've got it wrong. Within 10 minutes to 4 hours, you get a serious numbness, nausea and dizziness, which then progresses to slurred speech, blurred vision. Then you're in the big problem areas of paralysis and vomiting. And generally, if you've got the dose wrong, you will die within 6 hours. And between 1886 and 1963, there were 6,386 cases of this poisoning known.
So people would be so, so want to chase that elusive pleasure of risky fugu that they would...
Because they trust that they get it right, do they? Is it just that you sort of feel like you can go and you can eat this and it's safe?
Well, you can now. I mean, there's a very, very low mortality rate now because people are so on it. Well,
thank goodness.
In fact, the people who tend to die from it still are fishermen who just think, oh, I'll do it for myself. Now, it's been a problem. I didn't realise this, obviously. There's so much you learn when you're researching these. But Captain Cook's voyage of the South Pacific between 1772 and 75, it's quite clear that some of them were eating pufferfish with absolutely disastrous results. And even when they felt a bit sick from a tiny bit of the poison of pufferfish, they'd pass on the remains of the pufferfish to other animals or whatever, and they would die. So people learnt through example to avoid this very toxic thing.
Dickie, my partner, his brother lived in Japan for 30 years, and we were talking the other day, and he told me that they like chicken pink. Now, we would never, we would automatically send back, wouldn't we, chicken that had pinkness to it because we'd think that that's just salmonella waiting to take us. But in Japan, the custom is that you eat chicken pink. I don't know if that's simply they raise their chickens in a way which just makes it less
I wonder if they use a chemical or something. I don't know the answer to that.
He says it's a tradition. And again, those traditions are so, so meticulously observed that it would be considered
maybe the gut,
disrespectful.
Yeah, the gut gets used to it. I don't know.
You don't necessarily die immediately of pink chicken. I mean, it's likely to contain the bacteria,
have
but it doesn't
salmonella?
Have to.
Oof,
I haven't, no, but I the have. Point is you can eat it and still survive. But is it a similar thing that they sort of assume that there's a slight risk in that you have leave a tiny bit of the poison in?
There's a few dishes I came across researching, which I think would challenge us.
And we're adventurous.
We are adventurous. The first one you might well go for, actually, Richard, basashi. That's raw horse carpaccio. Absolutely, you know, what's the difference, I suppose, and all that. But I mean, frankly, if you like horses. But that at the moment, there's a big problem with that in recent years. There's a very bad parasite that's got into that.
Oh.
There's one called shirako, which translates as white children. It's fish testicles filled with the semen of the male fish. It doesn't really get me.
I'd try anything, actually.
Yes. And then this one is quite a new dish. I mean, a lot of the ones I'm talking about are very traditional. Enthusiasts have got together and over the last couple of decades, they've started a dish called jibashi senbei, which is crackers with black digger wasps baked into them. And they are wasp enthusiasts. Who
squash fly biscuits.
Garibaldis.
But real wasps.
Yeah.
When I went there, some of my colleagues went to a fish restaurant and had tuna eyeballs.
You've done salmon eyeballs, haven't you, Richard?
Yeah. I mean, I would try anything. I want to know that my fugu guy was fully qualified.
Yeah, exactly.
See the stiff guy.
Yeah. Well, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. Kat, you're from Norway. Your fisheries are famously stocked. You never have to walk very far to find someone offering you fish to eat. But you don't eat raw fish, do you? Why the raw fish thing in Japan? Why is that such a thing?
Well, it's cured. So it's almost the same, but it's just cured, the loss of the fish. So it's...
But
not
it's just
cooked.
Not a thing we do in Europe, particularly, is it? Raw fish is not really a thing. Whereas in Japan, it's just they wouldn't think twice about it, would they? Now we've all got used to it.
Well, you say we've now got used to it. It's very recent. I was surprised. You know, the first proper sushi restaurant in the States set up 60 years ago.
Really?
You know, over here, we think of Yo Sushi and the conveyor belt things. Moshi Moshi was the first one in 1994. So I just want to touch on wasabi, wild ginger, medicinal, anti-inflammatory, vitamin C. But I love the fact that in 2011, a team of chemists won a Ig Nobel Prize, is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes, because they came up with a smoke alarm for deaf people that uses a spray of wasabi to wake them up, which is quite an unusual thought.
Excellent idea.
And then a few faux pas. You mustn't ever, when you're eating Japanese food, you mustn't stand your chopsticks vertically in a dish. This is done as a funerary rite. Do not pass food between chopsticks, because family members pick out bones from cremated remains and pass them between each other at funerals. Don't take food from a shared plate with your personal chopsticks. That's very rude.
You'd hate that, wouldn't you?
Well, I would. That's double...
double dipping.
Doing everything. Do not cross your chopsticks on your plate. It's a symbol of death. And do not rub your chopsticks together. You see that? People do that because it indicates that they're cheap. And so essentially, I'm now going to go to my favourite fact, which I know will chime with Richard, because we have eaten lunch together in the local Japanese a few times. And I know you always go for the bento box.
Love a bento box.
And that started as a portable rice ball meal. And it was dried so it didn't spoil, and then eaten with water, or you just dried it. It was for long journeys. It wasn't for home. And you would have different contents depending on your job, depending on whether you worked in a forest field or as a fisherman. You'd get different protein in the middle of it. And essentially, my favourite fact is this, that there is a thing called a shakeshi bento, which means the revenge bento. And this would be packed by your wife if you had upset her. And it would be something uncooked. Rice would be in there as a sort of, look at that, this is what I think of you. Or just pickles. Or even she'd spell out rude words in there. It could also be arranged into an embarrassing picture. So I like the idea of a revenge bento.
So you'd maybe be sitting there having your lunch, thinking you've gotten away with whatever you've gotten away with, and all of a sudden the bento box appeared and you realise that you've been...
You're suddenly in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. A lot of trouble. I love the revenge bento.
Yes.
Amazing.
I'm going to start a chain called Revenge Bento.
Yes, I think that's very good.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
I've just finished a 7-month tour.
Yes.
Now, this could have fatal consequences for a man of my age and faiblesse, right? Because you end up having hotel breakfast every day, sausage, and a midnight kebab every night. It's really bad. The thing that has saved me from food death has actually been sushi. And when I say sushi, maybe I mean sashimi, I don't know. I was in Asda in Chorley, and I got a box of sushi with some soy and some wasabi and some of that pickle stuff. And I've become a bit addicted to it, actually. It seems to be the most perfect sort of fast food. The one thing I think I like more than anything, miso soup.
Mm.
Yes. I adore miso soup.
It's good.
Yeah, miso is a sort of paste at the base of it that's made from soybeans. But I think miso is a very good all-rounder, and that is an essential part of a Japanese meal.
You begin, don't you, with miso?
Yes, it's very important. I think it's quite salty, I suppose, but it's a very fine thing. And you have different curds, bean sauces that you can make it out of. The one we most have is that sort of beige one with chopped up spring onions. And
that's a
stalwart, really.
And that seaweed, which is slightly resistant to the bite, which I love.
I love that.
Yeah.
And also, it's very easy to get it in a sachet or something. You know, you can have it at home and just do it.
But isn't it interesting that the thought of cold rice and raw fish with fermented soy and a horseradish should be stocked on the shelves of a supermarket in an English northern post-industrial town. The success of it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I remember at home, we're open to the public, and very early on when I took over, so late 90s, I started to stock our cafe rather like a pret-a-manger, including, as they used to have at pret-a-manger, sushi boxes. And I got a very irate letter from a visitor who'd had a really grim visit by the sounds of things. Went through everything. She sounded possibly like a serial complainer. And she went through all the things that really had annoyed her that day. I think a wasp and things like that. And then she came to an absolute crescendo and she went, "And what's more, your Chinese fish wasn't even cooked." And that was the sushi box.
none of that.
Do you eat them in Norway?
What, sushi?
Big in Norway, sushi.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it wasn't really much of a thing when I was growing up. But the other thing that you mentioned, which really was, bringing me back again in my shopping mall days, yes, was the ramen noodles in a little sachet pack in the 90s. Massive.
You're meant to slurp them. That's another thing. That's a sign of you're enjoying them. Also, you're not really meant to use too many utensils, so you get close to the bowl and shove it in, really.
That's not you.
I found that very difficult. In fact, two nights ago, I was alone in London and I went to a Japanese restaurant, quite a basic one. And I was put next to this man. Well, first of all, he was talking to himself, which is always upsetting. and then a lot of slurping. I was really wishing for my earphones at that point. It was testing my English gentleman act. Anyway, we now go to the doctor.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think our disembodied voice has got something to say.
Oh. Yeah, so according to my research, in Japan, raw chicken dishes are prepared using a process known as seromushi, I'm really sorry for the pronunciation there, which involves poaching the chicken at a high temperature to kill any harmful bacteria before serving it raw. And they do also have something called chicken sashimi.
Oof. I had salmonella from Coronation Chicken, and it wasn't great.
No, it really
wasn't.
That's no good for anyone.
I love Coronation Chicken, but it's a risk I'm not prepared to take anymore.
Fair enough.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, Doctor. Right.
Yes, Dr. Jarman.
Yes, so I'm going to be talking about Esperanto, which I knew very little about, but I remember hearing about it. My mother ran a language institute when I was growing up, so there were always people talking about it, but nobody teaching it or learning it. But the meaning of the word is one who hopes, which kind of encompasses what it's all about.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so it is an invented language. Completely invented. And it was created by one man. He is called L.L. Zamenhof. He was Jewish. He was from a place in what's now Poland called Bialystok. He was originally trained as a doctor in Moscow. And he had this big vision, this big dream of a way for diverse people to communicate easily and peacefully. Because he had lived through so many conflicts and wars and thought that actually he wanted to find a way of promoting peace among people. So it comes from a really, really good place. Now, he knew an awful lot of languages. He actually knew 13 languages before he came up with this one himself.
Almost as many as you, Kat.
Well, not quite, but yeah, you know, nearly. I need to learn Esperanto. It wasn't the first one to invent a new language. That was actually quite a big trend at the time. And there were some that had been around for a century that he'd also learned that were quite popular. But what he did with this was essentially just take vocabulary from mainly European languages, English, French, a lot of it is based on Latin, really, so some German in there, a bit of Russian, a bit of Yiddish as well, and then a grammar that's largely European, although it has some Asian features as well. But the goal was essentially not to create a new primary language, but a second language, a universal second language, and one that was going to be easy to learn. So pretty much anyone from any background, any language could pick it up.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Because I would have thought, I think it's a fool's errand, this. You can't make up a language. It evolves, it's complex. Blah, blah, blah. But if it was a sort of technical language, then that actually might work.
Well, it is really, really interesting when you see what he's done. So things like it's got the nouns have no genders, for example. So anybody who's tried to learn German or anything like that.
Oh, that's a relief, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, all of those.
Well, also optimised for our own times, perhaps. Yes, so those issues absolutely. Are unloaded.
Absolutely. I grew up having to memorise. We had a test every Friday of English irregular verbs.
I'm sorry about that.
We had five every
torture.
Friday. It was a nightmare.
Yes.
Do you have gendered nouns in Norwegian?
We do.
Do you have a neuter noun?
Yeah, no, we do, yeah. So, but only really two of them are used very much. You just pick them up, it's weird. Yeah. But they're not the same as in German, for example, so you can't, it makes no sense.
You have to kind of relearn all
that. Yeah, completely, it makes no sense.
This makes Esperanto seem like a very good idea.
Great. Yes. Spelling is phonetic as well. Yeah. For example, there's one definite article, so libros is book, la libros, the book. All nouns end in an O, so you can easily just see that's a noun. If it's a plural, they add a J at the end of it. All adjectives end in an A. So it's super easy to sort of learn those rules.
Crack the code.
Yeah, basically. And so what he did was in 1887, he published a book called the Unua Libro, which is the first book. And that introduced and described the language. And he set out the 16 basic rules of it and the vocabulary, basically. That simply. Oh, and also he renounced all personal rights to it. So he didn't sort of trademark it or anything like that. It's great.
Very decent.
Because he wanted it to be the property of society. And so it was quickly spread around the world. And in fact, he got 14 Nobel Peace Prize nominations between 1907 and 1917. He never won it, but that was seen as such a benefit. And lots of famous speakers, including Pope John Paul II, was a speaker of
Spanish. That's a very good idea for a pope to do that.
You think so, wouldn't you? It sort of fits.
You already have a lingua franca. Yes. It's Latin, but I guess that's more helpful.
So we think this is a great idea. But very quickly, various governments started to see the dangers of this.
Oh.
So if you're a totalitarian state and you want to sort of contain your state, then this is not what you want. After World War I, the League of Nations, which was the predecessor to the UN, was founded, and the Iranian delegates proposed that Esperanto was to be adopted as the language of international relations. So it was actually vetoed by the French because they thought that that would actually reduce the use of the French language.
Gosh,
so they've
always been very on that, haven't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they eventually in the 20s, banned the teaching of Esperanto at universities for supposedly being a tool to spread communist propaganda.
Well, you could see if this were proposed, immediately a reaction to it would say, save our ridiculous language against this all-conquering, centralised, elitist doggerel.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I would like the peculiarities, the particularities of our language with our irregular verbs.
Yeah. Well, you can see so many different reasons, but interestingly, if we go to the more sort of extreme ends of it, Hitler absolutely didn't like it at all because it went directly against the Nazi ideology, really, because it had this internationalism and pacifism and equality, which went against this idea of having an Aryan superior race. And obviously also the inventor was Jewish, so that's not good in his eyes. So during the Third Reich, the Gestapo actually received specific orders to search for the descendants of Zamenhof. Okay. And all of his three children died in the Holocaust, as did many Esperanto speakers.
You were especially singled out.
Yeah, for that reason. Actually, his daughter-in-law and grandson survived and lived in Paris until quite recently. But interestingly, so there's all these sort of suspicions that this was going to promote communism. So you think, well, maybe in the Soviet Union it'd be more popular. It wasn't. So Stalin was especially against it. So Esperantists, as these people were called, were alleged to be part of an international espionage organisation. And Stalin actually persecuted huge numbers of Esperanto speakers who were all killed as well.
This is awful. I thought Esperanto was a jolly, sweet experiment. Yeah, I didn't realise you were persecuted for it.
Well, it was meant to be, but that's the thing. This was threatening different societies.
To totalitarian states, that's not...
So the idea was that they could correspond with foreigners more easily.
Oh, yes.
And it became difficult to revive again in the Soviet Union after Stalin's death. But it did get a bit better. And in 1954, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, passed a resolution recognizing the Universal Esperanto Association, which meant that this opened up for UNESCO and the cultural heritage events to actually use the language itself. And then later, it's in the 80s, moving onwards, it's been taught much more in schools. And in China, actually, lots of universities had as a foreign language option as well. And there's an Esperanto Museum in China. And then the other big thing that happened was actually with the invention of the internet.
Yeah.
Because previously it was very difficult to find other Esperanto speakers and to learn. And you had to be in a community and you have to get books and teach yourself. But in the early days of internet, it had a similar concept. So the sort of World Wide Web, this idea that you're bringing people together and it's very much of a collaborative effort. This was the first internet, which fit really nicely with the Esperanto communities. And so people started using online fora to actually communicate. And obviously now, with the way we use it now, it's extremely easy to find other Esperanto speakers online. So that had made it essentially a complete sort of revival of it.
Okay, are you one?
I'm not. And now I desperately want to learn it.
But so. You did learn it.
Esperanto.
So no, I didn't. No, I just heard about it. It was just sort of.
Oh, because your mum was a linguist.
Yeah, so it was always. There's a lot of talk about how positive this was as a sort of movement, really.
I associate it with earnest bicycling vegetarians in Dorking.
Yes. And I always thought, before all this, I thought it was something from the 60s, 70s, you know, when the European Union was beginning to take shape.
Interestingly, I think some of the things I really like about it was always invented to be a sort of neutral language as well. So there are no countries in the world that have adopted it as an official language or given official status, which is actually the success of it, because it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't meant to belong. That's why it's sort of a patchwork of different languages.
I've got a question, Kat.
Yeah.
Is there Esperanto sign language?
Ooh, that's a good one. I don't know. We'll have to see if maybe our disembodied voice can find out. I don't know if you can be. But I love this idea that Zamenhof, his motivations weren't really linguistic. They were trying to promote understanding and conditions for world peace, because he'd lived through this really conflicted time, especially conflicts between Russia and Poland, where he grew up. So I like that a lot. Do you want to hear my favourite fact?
Oh, yeah.
It's a tiny little one. It's one of the famous Esperanto speakers is Principal Skinner from The Simpsons.
Shut up. Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yes.
Of course he is.
Yes.
Yeah.
There we go. So I'm going to go.
Very good.
You can learn it on places like the apps, the Duolingo language learning apps.
Very nice. I mean, I'm glad it sort of survived, really, apart from anything else.
Yeah, so it's about 2 million speakers around the world now.
It'd be estimates. Nice to think you could, go on your holidays and not have to struggle your way through a menu in a language you don't know.
Yeah.
You could just say, I'd like some sardines on toast, grilled, if you like, to perfection. And you'd be understood in Timbuktu and Beijing and the Lofoten Islands.
Yes.
Lofoten Islands, sorry.
Thank you. Very good. Okay, have you got an answer for us, disembodied voice?
Yes, it looks like Sig Nuno. I'm really struggling with the pronunciations today. I'm working especially hard. Is signed Esperanto.
Okay, there we go.
Very good.
Fantastic.
Good question and good result.
I love that. Okay, well, disembodied voice, you need to announce the winner of this week's episode, please.
It would be really impressive if I announced it in Esperanto, wouldn't it? But I can't. But I am giving it to Kat this week.
Well done.
Bravo.
Which is well done in Esperanto.
I don't know what else to find out. However, thank you. Thank you. Oh, gosh, I haven't really prepared a speech in Esperanto.
But richly deserved. It's a fascinating
topic. Yeah, really good subject.
Yeah.
Okay, so finally then, we're going to have to let our listeners know what we're going to be going home to research for next week. And I'm going to talk about something that's a bit of a favourite of mine, which is radiocarbon dating.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Richard.
Yes.
The peculiar people.
Oh, yes.
Again,
is this from your address book, Richard?
It's just about us. Yes. And Charles, convict transportation.
Oh, I love a bit of that.
Yes. So that's it for this week. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Please subscribe and leave us a review, because it really helps people to find us when they're searching for a new podcast to listen to. You can also send us an email if you'd like, especially if you'd like to suggest a topic. That's rabbitholedetectives@gmail.com. So, in the words from Richard Adams' Watership Down, be cunning and full of tricks, and your people shall never be destroyed. Goodbye.
Oh, bye.
Bye.